Welcome to part two of this American Cassette Ministry series featuring Dr. Lewis Walton. This five-part series is entitled, Hear, O Israel, and we are discovering lessons of faith for our generation. And now let's join Dr. Walton as he introduces his second presentation entitled, The Law, A Divine Ideal.
We began our series by trying to show where we came from. You want to know where you are, it's nice to know where you began. Well, remember, when I was a young Navy officer, out on the Atlantic for the first time, we went east to Bermuda, about 500 miles. And in those days, the Loran radio fixes were not particularly good in that section of the ocean. Some days you would get a radio, a navigational fix, and other days you would not. And so the solution was to go back to the old-time celestial navigation. We would shoot sun lines and stars and so forth and put a fix on the chart, and we'd know about where we were. But east of Bermuda, there's a section of ocean where there's always a kind of a cloud cover, and we couldn't shoot sun lines, we couldn't shoot stars. We just drifted. We were on patrol out there. And finally, it was quite apparent that we were getting further and further from where we needed to be and had less and less idea where we were. And finally, the captain came on the bridge one day and he said, Mister, if you want to know where you are, it's a good idea to know where you've been. And so we plotted back on the currents of the ocean to where we started, got an idea of where we were then. And I think in a world that is evidently as dangerous and as unpredictable as the world in which we live today, it's a good idea to begin our search by going back and learning where we were. And so last night we talked about the first week of this world's history, Creation Week. And we saw God begin to build a world layer upon layer, truth upon truth, until the crowning act occurred. And into this intricate and beautiful world, filled with beauty, filled with truth, very complex interrelationship of life, he puts the crowning act, and that is two human beings made in the image of God himself. And we talked about the fact that these human beings were designed to bring glory and pleasure to God. And we talked about the fact that everything God made was good. Each evening of creation week, God looks at the world, the Lord looks at what he has made, and he says, behold, it is good. And you'll recall that we decided after reading from the wisdom of Solomon and from the prophets such as Ezekiel, that what was good about the world the Lord made was that everything he put in it related to everything else, and everything took from the system only to enrich with its own creativity and give back more than it got. Not only a self-sustaining reaction, but a self-enriching reaction. And as long as the system works that way, you'll go on forever. You will never die. There's eternity there. There's an eternal springtime of joy. And so the plants take our CO2 and give us back oxygen. And the sun expends of itself like God does to give us life and light. And human beings were intended to be in this world, to take from the beauty and wealth of this world, enrich what they have, each in his or her own way, and put back into the system. And then one terrible day in Eden, something went wrong. Now, I have a friend in California who is a very serious student of the Word, and he believes that there is reason and system to these cycles that God built into nature and into the Jewish feast system, the 49 and 50-year cycles of Jubilee and so forth. And he got an idea that maybe if he would reason backward from the establishment of the Jewish feast days and incorporate in other facts which were important to him in his research, he could figure out how long Adam and Eve were in the garden before they sinned. He gave me his little paper on it. It's many, many pages thick, filled with mathematical computations. I have no idea whether it is right or wrong, and I'm not sure it's even relevant to people who are, after all, facing an end-time world. But it's kind of interesting speculation. And according to his calculations, Adam and Eve were in the garden for years before the fall. Very possible they were. However long or short their stay was in Eden, something went wrong. And last night we talked about that. And Adam and Eve each made a mirror image of the same mistake. both of them decided to follow human feeling instead of a clear statement from God as to what human beings ought to do. Now, Eve faces a very powerful temptation in that she faces an argument she cannot scientifically disprove. And she says, yes, God told us everything in this whole place is ours, freely ours, except this one tree. And the response she gets from the arch-deceiver, Shatam, the accuser, is, you cannot have heard it right. You can't have read the Bible right, so to speak. You must have misinterpreted what God told you. Let me reinterpret Scripture for you based on newly discovered scientifically provable evidence. Now, the reason I dwell on that is that we are not immune from that mistake today. There's a great deal of talk today about reinterpreting the Word of God based on the wisdom that has newly come to us. And when we go reinterpreting too much, we need to remember that our mother Eve had brains many times the size of ours, both in physical size and in mental capability. She's right from the hand of God. God knows how to build a human brain, and all it can do over 6,000 years of sin is deteriorate. It isn't going to grow. So Eve, with her brain probably several times the capacity of someone like Einstein, faces this temptation, and she can't handle it, and she plunges into a black hole called sin. So let us be careful about this idea of reinterpreting the Word of God based on our wisdom, because we don't have too much. Well, Adam comes along and he sins for the mere image of that thing, the very opposite reason. Eve sins because it feels right. Adam sins because it feels better to sin than it does to lose the girl he loves, and he follows her into that black hole called rebellion. And so something goes wrong in Eden, and it happens because two human beings choose to follow feeling instead of external absolute truth. And something breaks in the human mind and soul. Something is so badly broken that it is genetically and spiritually passed on to us, and you and I are now inherently unable to follow our feelings and be safe. Follow our feelings, and sooner or later we will die. Now, God comes up with a solution, and that solution is what we're going to talk about this morning. God gives us an absolute. Let's go back to the analogy I gave you last night about flying. I've not flown on the East Coast here, but I've flown in the L.A. Basin, and if you can do that and survive, you can do it anywhere, I think. Because you not only have an awful lot of airplanes, you have a marine layer of coastal clouds that comes in and bumps up, washes up against those coastal mountains east of Hollywood and Pasadena. And into that, humanity has now stirred another mixture called smog. The end result is you cannot see very far when you get below about 2,500 feet. And so let's imagine now we are on an instrument approach to Los Angeles International. We're coming in from the north, as I typically do, and we come to a place in the sky which is an imaginary intersection where two radio beams cross, and it's called DART's intersection. And approach control tells us to descend and maintain 2,200 feet, and as we ease back on the power and let the nose of the airplane fall, we just glide into this washing mixture of coastal fog and automobile exhaust. And pretty soon we can see about as far as our wingtips and no further. We have lost the one thing that is most important for a pilot to maintain, and that is the horizon. Long as you have a visual horizon, you can tell when you're level, you see. But lose your horizon and you look outside the windshield at that opaque ground glass gray, and you have no idea whether you're level, turning, climbing, or descending. You have no way of knowing. Now, if you doubt that, all you need to do is get in an airplane with me, close your eyes for about 10 seconds, and when you open them again, you will see the world is not where it is supposed to be. It's tipped, and you won't have felt a thing. In an airplane, you cannot tell which way is up if you can't see the horizon. And I submit to you, folk, that is exactly what Adam and Eve did when they decided to follow selfish feeling and ignore the absolute of a thus saith the Lord. And they passed on that defect to us, and we are now perpetually in the clouds, and we have no way of knowing which way is up. And so God gives a remedy, the same remedy that pilots have when they can't tell which way is up. I like sometimes for complicated truths like this to simply try to find an example in the real world. It helps me understand things better because my mind is rather literal. It's a rather simplistic way of looking at things. And if I can see something in the concrete physical world that illustrates a spiritual truth, it is easier for me to understand the spiritual. I think it is rather evident that much of the human race thinks that way because the Hebrew language so richly does this over and over again. Things in the real world symbolize something in the spiritual world. And God gives us an instrument panel, and it is called the Law of God, and it is 10 meters which tell us whether we're flying level and on course or whether we're beginning to die. And that is God's solution to the problem of the breakdown of human morality after the fall of sin. So he gives us the law. And he says, look at the panel, look at those 10 norms of conduct, and when you see yourself deviating from those rules, you are beginning to die, even though internally you may not recognize or feel it. And he gives us the law amidst great majesty, doesn't he? Turn, if you will, to Exodus 19. Exodus 19, and let's look at verses 18 and 19. Exodus 19, 18 and 19. And Mount Sinai was altogether on a smoke, because the Lord descended upon it in fire. And the smoke thereof ascended as the smoke of a furnace, and the whole mount quaked greatly. Well, I suppose it would. Yahweh himself is there. The I Am is there. The individual who spoke this world into existence now comes onto an 8,500-foot peak in the Middle East. And when he touches matter, the whole earth convulses. And when the voice of the trumpet sounded long and waxed louder and louder, Moses spake, and God answered him by voice. Now go down to the same two verses in the next chapter. Verses 18 and 19 of Exodus 20. And all the people saw the thunderings and lightnings and the noise of the trumpet and the mountain smoking. And when the people saw it, they removed and stood afar off. And they said unto Moses, speak thou with us, and we will hear, but let not God speak with us, lest we die. The law of God so clearly defines sin that in its presence, you see, you recognize how far you are off course and how dangerous life is without it. And so this group of people, several million people at the foot of Sinai, see the visible manifestations of the presence of God and hear the law, and instantaneously they feel condemned in the presence of the holy law of God. God gives the law in majesty. 10 simple rules. Do this and thou shalt live. Now the question that occurs to us this morning is, with 10 rules so logical, so obvious, and so clear, why is it then that 3,500 years later we still find the human race in such abysmal disobedience? We've had this truth for a long time. 1,500 years before the Common Era, 2,000 years since, 3,500 years of this truth clearly given by God on Sinai and written in his own handwriting on stone. And yet the human race fails to line up with the simplest concepts of survival. Why? Well, this morning I think I'd like to address that in three brief separate answers. I can look at this problem of the human failure in the presence of the law of God, and I think I see at least three reasons why we continue to fail. And I think they're reasons that are potentially the pitfall of any one of us, because we're all cut out of the same human nature. Now, the first rule that I see here is that we can unintentionally, but nonetheless, in all actuality, relate to the law of God as an abstraction rather than as a personality. It's very easy to relate to these 10 rules and this majesty we see on Sinai as an abstract truth. These are truths we must do. And it's very difficult, in the face of a powerful temptation, to maintain loyalty to nothing more than an abstract principle. I suggest to you the solution for that particular problem is to recognize that we ought to maintain loyalty to a person, not to just an abstract principle. And therein, I think we will find it easier. Now think about it a moment. Say that you're coming back to the city. You've been down in Jersey. You're coming up the Garden State Parkway. You know what the speed limit is, but it's very late, or should I say very, very early. It's dark. There is not a lot of traffic around. You pass the speed limit sign, but you say, I'm tired. Home is just around the next few turns. I want to get there a little sooner. And the foot goes down on the accelerator. There is not within us an inherently high level of loyalty to an abstraction such as the speed limit. Very, very easy. Very easy to say, well, the speed limit is there, but the sign won't know the difference, and I'm going to speed. Now change the picture just a little bit, and instead of the sign, you look in your mirror, and there is a New Jersey State Trooper. Now you're dealing not with an abstraction, but with a human being, a person. Does it make a difference in your behavior? Of course it does. Let's go to another illustration. A couple of teenagers are in from a date Saturday night. They're sitting on the living room couch. They become very, very attracted to each other. Things go from bad to worse. There is no human way this temptation is going to get overcome. Then Dad walks into the room. And temptation disappears like frost before the morning sun. It doesn't exist anymore. Very easy to relate to an abstraction in a disloyal way. But when a human being is involved, it's very much harder, you see. Now, is there an illustration of this in Scripture? In the last couple of years, maybe 3 years, we have seen even television evangelists tumble before powerful temptation. Men who had preached to others could not in the privacy of their own lives live the principles that they had clearly enunciated. Is there an example of how that kind of temptation should be met? Sure there is. Turn to the book of Genesis, chapter 39. And you know the story. Here is Joseph. If ever anyone were unfairly dealt with, he was. Unfairly turned upon by members of his own family, sold into slavery, and if there is any moral wrong in God's green earth, it is slavery. Whether it exists in Iraq in 1990, or in the United States in the 1850s, or back in the time of Joseph, when a human being is deprived of his God-given liberty and forced to do something that is not an act of his own free will. There is nothing more abhorrent to the character of God than slavery. Why? Because God gave his son to die for the sake of preserving human liberty. Now, Joseph has been sorely dealt with. It would have been very easy for him to say under these circumstances, I worship God. I worship the God of my fathers. I was a faithful follower of God, and look what it got me. Now, here I am in Egypt. I am wrongfully and immorally enslaved in this man's house, and here's a chance for me to even the score, and nobody will ever know. From a human point of view, there's a great deal of reason why Joseph might be very attracted to the temptation that presents itself to him when Potiphar's wife comes along with a proposition that in his heart he knows is wrong. It is antithetical to the law of God. So Joseph faces that temptation, and look at verse 9. How does he handle it? He says, how then can I do this great wickedness and sin against the law? Now, did I read that correctly? No. Joseph is not thinking here of an abstraction called law. He's thinking of a person, a real, live, cognizant person who can get hurt when he turns his back on truth. There's the difference. Joseph was not supported in his stand against that temptation by an abstraction, by a principle. It was by knowing personally somebody that it mattered to whether he would survive that temptation or not. So I suggest point number one is do not look at the law of God, as magnificent and logical as it may be. Don't look at it as an abstraction. Look at it as a person. Now, a great Jewish writer one time told the story of creation and of life in these words. Let me read them to you from a recent translation. When all things began, the Word already was. The Word dwelt with God, and what God was, the Word was. The Word then was with God at the beginning, and through Him all things came to be. No single thing was created without Him. All that came to be was alive with His life. He was in the world, but the world, though it owed its being to Him, did not recognize Him. But to all who did receive Him, to those who have yielded Him their allegiance, He gave the right to become children of God. In other words, the law is not a set of words, nor even verbiage written on stone in God's own hand. It's a living thing. And look upon it as a person, and I think you'll find it much more difficult to turn your back on it. So, point number one, the reason why humanity so often fails in the face of God's law and its requirements is that we look at the law as only words as opposed to being a person. Turn it around, I think you will find it makes a difference. Point number two, I think that because human beings are essentially somewhat egocentric, and because we tend to believe we have more power than we actually do, we've made a fundamental mistaken assumption in relating to the law. And I think the mistaken assumption is that we believe that because we agree something is true and right, we therefore will be able to do it. That is not so. Go back, if you will, to Exodus 19. Look at Exodus 19, 18 and 19 one more time. We will see the law given in its majesty, and then we will see the people of God make a promise. And Mount Sinai was altogether on a smoke, because the Lord descended on it in fire, and the smoke thereof ascended as the smoke of a furnace, and the whole mount quaked. And when the voice of the trumpet sounded long and waxed louder and louder, Moses spake, and God answered him by voice. And what did God say? I am the Lord thy God, which have brought thee out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. Thou shalt have no other gods. And nine other rules. That's the commandment, you see. Now, when the children of Israel heard these truths said so clearly, what did they respond? Look here at Exodus 19:8. And all the people answered together and said, all that the Lord hath spoken, we will do. You suppose they meant that? Nobody has ever been more sincere in the history of the world in meaning what they said. They're standing in the visible presence of incarnate God. Almighty Himself is there visibly present. The mountain's on fire. The whole ground is shaking. And the state trumpet of the cosmos is blowing. You suppose you would be sincere when you said, everything I have heard, I will do. Sure, and I'll make it just about 40 days before I fail. We human beings make the mistaken assumption because we agree something is right, we're able to do it. And we forget the story of Eden. Something went wrong in our circuit boards that night in Eden, and it hasn't been fixed. And if you, in your own strength, as a human being, believe that you're capable of doing right simply because you agree with it, you're as wrong as you can be. Now, I love the writings of Moses and the prophets and the great thinkers since that time who have explored religious truth. And there is a great Jewish theologian who explained the human dilemma in words that I think are the experience of every one of us. Here is what he said. Wherefore, the law is holy, and the commandment holy, just, and good. For we know that the law is spiritual, but I am carnal, sold under sin. For that which I do, I allow not. For that what I would, or for what I would, I do not. But what I hate, that I do. For I know that in me, that is in my flesh, dwelleth no good thing. For to will is present with me, but how to perform that which is good, I find not. Now, there's the breakdown in the human circuit boards. In other words, we look at the law, we recognize that it is holy, just, and good, and we want to do it. Now, I love the writings of Moses and the prophets and the great thinkers since that time who have explored religious truth. And there is a great Jewish theologian who explained the human dilemma in words that I think are the experience of every one of us. Here is what he said. Wherefore, the law is holy, and the commandment holy, just, and good. For we know that the law is spiritual, but I am carnal, sold under sin. For that which I do, I allow not. For that what I would, or for what I would, I do not. But what I hate, that I do. For I know that in me, that is in my flesh, dwelleth no good thing. For to will is present with me, but how to perform that which is good, I find not. Now there's the breakdown in the human circuit boards. In other words, we look at the law, we recognize that it is holy, just, and good, and we want to do it. And then our own performance in our own lives tells us there is something within our human beings' makeup that simply denies us the accomplishment we would like to do. He goes on at quite some length on the problem. For I delight in the law of God after the inward man, but I see another law in my members warring against the law of my mind and bringing me into captivity to the law of sin which is in my members. So then with my mind I serve the law of God, but with my flesh I serve the law of sin. Now the point that I'm wanting to make here, point number two, is that it is a mistaken assumption to assume we can do something simply because we know it's right. Something else has to happen to us. And David finally grasped that in the 19th Psalm, didn't he? Psalm 19:12. Let's take a look at it. Psalm 19, verse 12. Who can understand his errors? Now, yet David is an individual who has known the law. He has, so to speak, read the Torah. He's got much of it committed to memory. David is so close to God that through him, almost unparalleled, God will be able to pass through the experience of what Messiah will feel when he comes to this earth. And David lives those things through and describes them in several of the Psalms. Psalm 21, 22, 23, 24, along in there, you know. So David is very close to God. He understands the law. But the law he understands does not prevent him from falling into sin, does it? He knows that the law says, thou shalt not commit adultery and thou shalt not kill. And yet he is capable in a moment of overwhelming temptation of doing both. And so David in the 19th Psalm speaks of this particular problem. Verse 12, who can understand his errors? I don't even understand why I did these things. Cleanse thou me from what? Secret faults. Point number two is that even though it is important to agree that the law of God is right and binding on us, we need something supernatural to occur in our lives, or we're doomed forever throughout our lives to see the standard and never meet it. In other words, we need something called religious conversion, and until it happens, the word is only words. Now, David gives us an insight here into point number three that fascinates me. He talks about secret faults. What do you suppose he means by that? What are the secret faults that are nagging at David's mind so that he feels it necessary to pray for healing from that problem? I'm asking. You have any thoughts on that point? All right, now you've raised an interesting point. You're saying that David may be raising the issue of secret sins that he's aware of, doesn't always maybe act them out so that other people would know, but they're gnawing at his soul, and he needs victory over those. Yes, please, another point of view.
I think he's talking about our thoughts. Jesus said that if we lust in our heart, it's an adultery. So only God can read our thoughts, and these are the things he wanted God to take away, even these perverse thoughts.
All right, now what you're saying is that the law is much broader than merely external behavior. And the Old Testament Bible, the Holy Scriptures, does say that when Messiah comes, he will magnify the law, doesn't it? And magnifying the law would be to say that it is not only the externals that you do, but your motivations. Is there a possibility that even though you don't have the opportunity to sin, you would do it if you had the opportunity, and therefore you're guilty of it, even though you never acted out? You have heard it said, thou shalt not commit adultery, but he that looks upon a woman to lust, for example, hath already done it in his mind, even though the physical act hasn't occurred. Magnifying the law. So what you're saying is that this may refer to the broad scope of the law, broader than we sometimes realize it is. Yes?
And it's only secret because between him and God, nobody else knows.
All right, secret because only God and the person knows. Is there a possibility that there is a level of secret sin within a person that even the person himself or herself may not yet have confronted? Let me, because of the shortness of time, short-circuit just a little bit and go back to the Word here and get on to this point. Jeremiah 17:9 says what about the human heart and the human motivations? The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? Doesn't that sound like David? Cleanse thou me from secret faults. I don't understand my errors, God. Cleanse me from faults. I do not understand myself. Now, how can it be, when the human being ought to know himself or herself pretty well, that we could have within us a level of motivation that we ourselves do not understand? Kind of a puzzlement, isn't it? Yes, you have a thought on that.
The thing is, our minds have been so corrupt that we think our actions in a way that makes
all right, what you're saying is that our minds are so corrupt that wrong may seem to be right. What you're saying is that at the fall, Adam and Eve fell into that same trap. Wrong seemed to be right. We have inherited their disability, and so we too can feel that we're flying level when we're actually in a descending turn because we don't have the horizon of that undamaged mind and that clear view of God. Yes, please. All right.
If it was, we would be united together. We wouldn't have to do all the preaching. We would get on the way of working for the Lord.
What you're saying then is that we have the truth, but we don't have the love of God, and therefore we don't have unity, and we don't have a full expression of truth. Very good point. One more, please. All right. What you've said there is really that basically temptation is sometimes very attractive to the human mind. That's exactly right. Temptation is naturally attractive to the carnal individual. Therefore, our highest promises at the foot of Sinai will crumble in 40 days when our leader is gone. We cannot see where Moses is. We're facing a dry, hot desert with no visible sign of support. And back in Egypt, we at least know what we had. And meanwhile, we are attracted by a pagan religion which welds human selfishness, materialism, and immorality. And it's very easy to fall back into that. Even though we have heard the law and seen the divine ideal, our humanity resonates to temptation. One more point, then I'm going to move on. All right, what you're saying is that Eve was genuinely confused by temptation. Adam was not, but he nonetheless sinned. Is not Adam a type of the individual that we just heard described, which says, in my mind I serve the law, but in my members I find myself doing something else? Now, you raised an interesting point in saying that sometimes we do things because we strongly feel the urge to do it. The question I want to put to you folk is, why do you feel that urge? Why is one person strongly attracted, almost uncontrollably attracted to one temptation, while another person may not be bothered by that first temptation, but is strongly attracted to something else. That's what I'm wanting to get at here, the secret faults that we find within our souls. I'm going to have to move on just because of the lack of time. Why was it that Jeremiah said, "Your own mind is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. You don't understand yourself"? I think it occurs in part because much of what we are as adults was imprinted in our personalities before we ever reached an age where we can consciously remember very much. Did any of you folks see within the last year and a half an article in the Reader's Digest magazine entitled "The Fascinating World of the Unborn"? You see that one? Let me share just a few sentences because I think it will tell you why it is that sometimes we don't know why we do the things we do. I'm reading to you right now from that article. "For 8 months he has floated in his private ocean. This morning he awakens, opens his eyes, yawns, and kicks vigorously several times." This is being taken, by the way, these are real-time photographs being taken of a child before birth with fiber optic type of equipment we now have, and also real-time ultrasound, so that we can see what the child is doing before birth. So they watch this little fellow. They see him open his eyes, yawn, and kick vigorously several times. His umbilical cord drips by his questing fingers. He plays with it briefly, brings his hands up to his mouth, and sucks his thumb. Over his mother's heartbeat, he can hear her talking with his father. Interested, he stops sucking to listen. Now, he will not understand the words. That will come. But you suppose that brain, that fully developed human brain, can pick up voice tone? His mother begins to walk, and the motion rocks him gently back to sleep. A radio startles him awake. He blinks and grimaces at the new sensations, but then becomes interested in the music. He turns his head to bring his ear closer to the outside world. What is he hearing? His mother falls heavily on one hip. He is much too well cushioned to experience any injury, but her pain and the fear that she may have hurt him floods both their bodies with adrenaline. He cries and kicks vigorously, a cry never heard because there is no air to make sound. As she recovers, the stress hormones ebb away and he calms down too. Now, any of you remember the time before you were born? My little boy used to tell me he could remember being born, and some of his descriptions leave me wondering if he may have, although I have reason to sometimes doubt it. But what about once you are born? How many of you remember anything in your first year of life? Second year? By the time you're 3, you're beginning to have a few scattered memories you can relate to. But in those first 3 years, plus the prenatal time, that beautiful human mind that is just hungry for data is sucking in data quicker than it ever will do again. Now, what are we told? In the first 3 or 4 years, the mother has largely put her imprint upon the baby, and that becomes the personality. And you can't even access that by memory. Now, you want to know why Jeremiah said the mind is deceitful above all things? You don't even know, because much of what you are and do comes from a time you don't even consciously remember. Now then, consider that with that problem of an unplumbed depth of motivation that you yourself cannot even access, you also have passed on to you the genetic breakdown that sin caused in the human family. Is it any wonder you can look at the law and say, "With my mind, I love that thing, but in my behavior, I see something very different"? See the problem? Now, what did the rabbis say? If for one day in Israel everybody in the whole nation could live a perfect life, Messiah could come? Remember that? And Messiah isn't here yet, because nobody has ever done it in the whole church, so to speak, even for one day. There's the problem. Is there a solution for that thing? Because I think there is some truth in what the rabbis say. I think that Messiah is, in fact, waiting for people to reflect the character and goodness of God. See? Now, faced with the disability of a broken human heart, broken human mind, broken circuit boards, how do you solve the problem? I suggest to you this morning that there is an answer, and it's found in Yom Kippur, Day of Atonement. Let's turn to Leviticus 16, shall we? You folk are no doubt aware that Leviticus 16 is the central chapter in the book of Leviticus, and rightly it should be because it deals with the central topic, cleansing of the sanctuary, Day of Atonement. And look at Leviticus 16, and let's go to verse 29. And this shall be a statute forever unto you, that in the seventh month, on the tenth day of the month, ye shall afflict your souls. Now, what does that word afflict mean? Anak, Hebrew word anak, what does it mean? Any thoughts on this? Intensive self-examination, denial of your wishes for the sake of truth. Anything I see in my soul that is at variance from the will of God, I will face openly and honestly. I will throw no barriers up to hide behind. Okay? Affliction of soul, searching of the heart on Yom Kippur. That's why it was so important that the people were ready in all those tents lined up in those four quadrants of the sanctuary under the standards of the lion, the eagle, the ox, and the man, the four characteristics of Messiah. Spreading outward from the sanctuary temple, as it were, in the four directions that would symbolize the four facets of Messiah's work. And on that day, everyone stands clean. Whole camp is clean. The high priest now goes in before Shekinah, you see. It's a serious business. It's a cleansing of sin from the heart of Israel. And while it's going on in the sanctuary, what is going on in the individual Jewish heart? A cleansing, an introspection, a looking for of sin. Now, it's quite clear from Daniel 10:12, the same word comes. Remember in the times of Daniel 10, he's trying to understand this great 2300-year vision that he's so perplexed about. It affects his people. He wonders, will it be 2,300 years before Messiah comes to Israel? He is so burdened with this thing, he's physically ill. Finally, he gives himself up to fasting and prayer and intercessory prayer for God's people. And Daniel 10:12 uses that same word, anach. He is chastening his soul. He is looking for any ways in which he is out of harmony with the will of God. It seems to me that there is a principle that we learn from Leviticus and from Yom Kippur, that behavior any other time which might possibly be acceptable is sin on the Day of Atonement. It's a time for searching of heart. Why? Because the Holy Spirit of God on that special time is especially cooperating, searching your heart for sin to bring to your conscious awareness those areas in which you differ from the will of God. Now, you folk probably recognize that in Daniel 7, 8, and 9, that great 2300-year prophecy pretty well specifies what will happen when in the history of this world. Remember Daniel 8 says, from the time of the decree of the rebuilding of Jerusalem, 70 weeks are determined upon the people of Israel. That's part of an overall larger 2300-year vision. Historically, it's quite clear that in 457 BCE, a decree, the final decree to rebuild Jerusalem, rebuild the temple in Jerusalem, went forth from the Persian emperor then on the throne. You add 2,300 years to that, and you come to the autumn of the year 1844, Common Era, and that's just about 150 years ago, folk. And if, in fact, the prophet Daniel knew what he was talking about when he recorded the divine message unto 2,300 years, then shall a sanctuary be cleansed, it seems to me that you and I very well may be living in the great, ultimate, antitypical Day of Atonement. And if that is so, it's time for this searching of heart and searching of soul. And it's time to let the Holy Spirit of God cooperate in that function. And I think if you will look at it in that way and allow God to cooperate with you in searching for areas in which you are at variance from the will of God, you're going to find your mistakes not to be a discouraging effect, but an encouragement. Have you ever had the experience of spending an hour or two in the morning early on in the Scriptures, praying earnestly, resolving and promising to God that today will be different and people will see the nature of God in you and you will treat people right. And it lasts until you hit that first five-way stoplight and some thoughtless person cuts in front of you and you miss the light. And you say or do something that surprises you and you're discouraged. You say, oh boy, I'm not the person I thought I was. I'm not making any progress. I'm not pleasing God. I didn't know I still had that in me. And you're discouraged. Might I suggest to you this morning that is not a time for discouragement. It's a time to be encouraged. Because the work of the Spirit of God on Yom Kippur is to plumb the depth of your life and force to your attention those areas in which you still are out of harmony with God. And maybe it takes that five-way light and the thing you blurted out that you wish you hadn't said to bring to your mind areas at which you still have work to do. See? Now, when that happens, what do? You simply say, I recognize there's sin in my life. There's something I thought I did no longer had or something I never knew I did have. But now I see it and I have a very simple choice to make. I would rather have the Lord than that sin. And you put it on the level of a person. You don't say, oh, I broke the law. I'm sorry, law. You say, I would rather have a person. I would rather have the Lord than that sin. And I think you will find it a whole lot easier to turn your back on temptation, however powerful it may be, when you realize that you're putting up against that temptation a living, breathing individual who loves you enough to come to this world and give everything he has to guarantee your right to live forever. So might I suggest to you this morning that the majesty of the law find its fulfillment in our recognition that it condemns our behavior, but that there is a supernatural solution to this thing, and it is especially relevant on Yom Kippur, especially post-1844. And now with that in mind, let's go back to the words of that great writer who described how the world began. And I think as we hear these words, we will recognize that in our quest for obedience to the law, we desperately need something. We need somebody. You and I need Messiah. When all things began, the Word already was. Through Him all things came to be. No single thing was created without Him. All that came to be was alive with His life. He was in the world, but the world, though it owed its being to Him, did not recognize Him. But to all who did receive Him, to those who have yielded Him their allegiance, He gave the right to become children of God, the offspring of God Himself. So the Word became flesh. He came to dwell among us, and we saw His glory, such glory as befits the Father's only Son, full of grace and truth.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. This recording has been digitally reprocessed from the original audio cassette or reel-to-reel in order to make this CD available. The audio quality was improved as much as possible. International copyright, American Christian Ministries. All rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americanchristianministries.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with our speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.